Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
I may need to knock on wood here, but it does feel like summer is breaking. We have had a few cooler temperatures here in Austin, Texas, and football's back. Outdoor cooking is back. And of course, we're back in the studio to talk about another perennial topic in environmental law. At the Environmental Law Monitor, as you may have heard me say a few times, we'd like to talk about new developments in environmental and natural resources law and policy, but we also like to revisit important topics, what we call perennial topics that are distinctive topics in the practice and contribute to a well-rounded environmental practice.
And so I'm excited today to be joined by Jason Hutt again, and we're going to be talking about an important case that continues to come up. It's a relatively older case called the United States versus Best Foods. It's a Supreme Court decision, and it comes up in a lot of different contexts. So Jason, welcome back. And I know you've spent a lot of time with U.S. versus Best Foods. So excited to hear from your insights on how to handle this case, how to make sense of it, how to apply it to a variety of contexts. So welcome back.
Thanks for having me back on. And I think Best Foods came out from the United States Supreme Court in 1998 when I was a first year associate. It was one of the very first client alerts that I wrote. So bringing me back to my beginnings. Happy to be here.
That's awesome. And so you've gotten to see how companies have wrangled with the case, drawn lessons from the case over your entire career. That's great. Couldn't think of anyone better to have here for the discussion. So to just talk about the facts of Best Foods, briefly, the United States sought to recover costs under CERCLA from the corporate parent of a chemical company that had generated a variety of hazardous wastes at its facility, but that chemical company had gone defunct. So when the United States sought recovery from the parent corporation, the parent defended itself, saying it had neither owned nor operated the chemical plant directly. It hadn't been involved directly in the generation of hazardous waste. So that gave rise to a question that the Supreme Court addressed. Under what circumstances can a court under CERCLA hold a parent corporation liable for the actions or management practices of a subsidiary? The Supreme Court articulated a couple of conditions or circumstances in which a court would hold that parent corporation liable. The first was in the context of corporate veil piercing. If you're familiar with business associations law or the law of business organizations, you will have heard this term before. If a company adopts a corporate form and misuses it, right, and makes fraudulent representations about what the corporation and its subsidiary are up to, or if the subsidiary is grossly undercapitalized,
courts may pierce the corporate veil and hold a parent company or hold a shareholder in some circumstances responsible and liable for the actions or omissions of the subsidiary. That analysis is performed under applicable state law. But our interest here is really on the environmental aspect of Best Foods. The second holding in that case is that when a parent corporation functions as an operator, not merely an owner, then it may also become responsible or liable for the subsidiary's liabilities with respect to hazardous waste management and a variety of other topics to be deemed an operator.
Under Best Foods, a parent company is not going to encounter liability simply by engaging in activities that are consistent with parent investor status. So like monitoring a subsidiary's performance, supervising the subsidiary's finance and capital budget decisions, articulating general policies and procedures. Those are all consistent with what a parent company does.
And this is a fact-specific analysis and with difficult fact-specific questions. So Jason, I'm hoping you can help us start to sort out the holding of Best Foods.
Yeah, sure. So go back to CERCLA. And I think it's important to just remind everyone what CERCLA attempted to do, which was cast a very broad net to ensnare potentially responsible parties to share the liability for the release of a hazardous substance at a site, the response costs associated with that. And it's a strict liability concept that ensnares the owners, the operators, the arrangers, and the transporters of the hazardous substance that comes to the site. And basically the idea behind behind it is to ensnare those who were in a position to control the risk, right? The risk that went bad by having a release of the hazardous substance to the environment. Not necessarily whether they were in compliance with law, but whether they were in a position to control that risk. So then you get to Best Foods, and the first part of whether you can get to a parent because of the wrongs of a subsidiary or the liabilities of a subsidiary is the traditional route, which is the veil person question. And you, as you outlined, it's a function of state law, right? Because corporations are created under state law. And there are every state has its own corporation laws and determines what the hallmarks of corporate separateness are that prevent veil piercing. That's really a corporate law question. And the Supreme Court put that aside and said, okay, you don't need to pierce the veil if the parent acts in a way that puts itself in the position of the operator. Are they in the position to control the risk that happens or manifests at the site? And then they looked for the indicia of a parent behaving like an operator at the site, even if it was the subsidiary whose name was on the permit for operatorship purposes. They were looking for those indicia. And that's ultimately, I think, what came from the case is that you could pin the tail on the parent, not by piercing the veil in the traditional sort of corporate way, but rather by saying, well, the acts that you took or by the, and this was sort of came from the cases that came after Best Foods, or by the rights that you held to take certain acts vis-a-vis the site from a day-to-day decision-making standpoint, from a deployment of capital standpoint that controlled that risk, that's what pulls you into the net of potentially responsible parties. And that's what potentially pins the tail on the parent in that circumstance. Although in the Best Foods case, we were talking about a parent-subsidiary relationship. But really the question is, even if you're not the operator of a site, what are the things that you might do or what are the rights that you might hold that could cause EPA to assert that you were in fact an operator at the site because of the way that you acted or the rights that you held for the ways that you would act? And if you were in the position to control the risk that manifested itself into response costs, then we're going to pull you into the net of potentially responsible parties. And you're going to share, you know, jointly and severally in the liabilities associated with the response costs that are incurred consistent with the National Contingency Plan, which is what CERCLA sets out.
And that's let's dig a little bit deeper into those indicia of you know, when a corporate parent might become an operator because of the rights and responsibilities they have with respect to a subsidiary's facility or a subsidiary's various compliance programs or other operations.
So, Jason, with that in mind, that CERCLA wants to cast a wide net over potentially responsible parties. And that brings us back to the case itself and what you termed the indicia or indicators of operator status. If I'm a general counsel of a company that has affiliates or subsidiaries, how do I know whether a CERCLA tail is going to end up being pinned on me?
Sure. So I think at the top level, it goes in probably two different directions. The first would be on a going forward basis. How does my entity touch a site in ways in which those touches could be characterized as being in a position to control environmental risk, right? So, and I would not isolate that to the Best Foods circumstance where it was just a parent and subsidiary. Mm-hmm. I think the question is, how does the entity that I'm the general counsel to touch those sites, whether that's as a joint venture partner, whether that's as a lessor, a lessee, a sublessee, the owner of the equipment that's at the site, but not the building, the lender to the site, a co-location at that site, any of those circumstances, the questions start to become relevant of, am I putting myself in a position where I could be fairly characterized as an operator? And if there were environmental liabilities, would those touches with the site or the rights that gave me the ability to touch the site put me into the net of potentially responsible parties under Section 107. So that's one category or bucket of things to be thinking about. And then if you're in acquisition mode, you also want to be thoughtful about the legacy liabilities of the entities or people that you're acquiring, the assets or entities that you're acquiring, right? Because, and this isn't really what Best Foods is about, but I think people use Best Foods to capture these concepts of legacy liabilities associated with companies. And that means if I'm in a stock or a merger circumstance, then I'm stepping into the shoes of the corporate entity. And so I may be deemed a corporate successor to those liabilities. And so I need to be thoughtful about not just all of the current facilities that the entity I'm acquiring owns or operates, but all of its past facilities and businesses that it has owned and operated, because those liabilities can be visited upon me as the successor to that entity. And then separate from that, if I'm in an asset circumstance, if I'm purchasing all or substantially all of the assets of a company, then as a matter of corporate law, I can be the de facto or de jure successor to that entity, and the environmental liabilities of that entity can be visited upon my company by virtue of the fact that I'm deemed to be the corporate successor as a matter of fact or law. So that's not in the Best Foods sort of holding, but I think it is in the category of things that counsel needs to be thinking about in transactional circumstances or in commercial relationships, where you're trying to figure out, you know, which of these liabilities am I potentially biting off? And then how do I protect myself, right? So that separately brings up, well, can I protect myself by reducing the legal indicia or the factual indicia, mm-hmm. I guess, of being an operator. Mm-hmm. And then I can protect myself through good practices, right? To not have the release of the hazardous substances. And I can protect myself contractually, right? Where I gain indemnification, representations, warranties, covenants, things like that to mitigate the liability. That doesn't make it go away, but it gives me a right of recovery against someone else in the circumstance where those liabilities are visited upon my entity. And then, you know, there are other ways to manage that liability. Insurance would be probably the first that comes to mind, right? You can insure some of that risk to move it off of your balance sheet from a management perspective. So I think those are the two categories, right? Legacy liabilities and indicia of operatorship liabilities that you would want to be thinking about in those different circumstances.
Let's look a little bit more at the indicia of operator status, because one of the things that I have come across in not just Best Foods, but other cases applying or drawing lessons from Best Foods is that there are circumstances where a parent company, or like you pointed out, it doesn't have to be a parent subsidiary relationship, but an entity can be involved in the operations, an affiliate or a subsidiary or a sublessee or something along those lines that help us understand whether somebody's an operator or not. So one of the things I've come across, and I'd be curious to see what else you've seen in the case law following Best Foods. For example, when a company directly approves a variety of compliance actions of a subsidiary, courts have found that parent company can be liable for the actions of its subsidiary because that's that sort of day-to-day control over operations. What are some other things that you've seen in your practice where you've either come across a case where a court has found that a parent is liable, or you've just sort of counseled, hey, this is a best practice?
I don't have mastery of the case law at hand for you, but I would say other places where we commonly raise a flag and say, hey, these could be things that courts will test, would be decisions about capital expenditures, right? That particularly if the operator at the site, the named operator at the site, recommends some sort of capital expenditure and the parent, shareholder, lessor, whomever it is that's outside of that box, dictates a lesser solution, then they have participated in the decision-making that may give rise to a release of hazardous substances. And that's when something like this could be put to the test. The presence of EHS personnel who are employed by someone other than the named operator at the site can push a parent, a JV partner, someone like that, more closer to the operatorship role, because you're lending employees to do the work of the subsidiary or joint venture party. But the EHS personnel are personnel who are employed by and receive checks from, you know, someone else who is invested in the company. That starts to sound like the company is using those people to make the day-to-day decisions of the named operator entity. Presence on the board and committees of the board would be another indicia of, you know, does the board have an EHS committee? Who sits on that committee? What decisions are made by that committee? Those start to be things that you look at more closely if you have concerns about an environmental liability needing to be visited upon someone other than the named operator. right? So environmental law abhors a vacuum that leaves that liability to the public or to the other joint and several responsible parties that don't think that, you know, from an equitable standpoint, they should bear that responsibility. And so those are the circumstances in which they start to push the bounds of what best foods means and inviting the court to look at different facts as indicators of operatorship.
On the subject of shared roles, whether that's with EHS personnel, officers, directors, it sounds like it's really important to define the roles that you're undertaking in the parent role and the subsidiary role or in the other roles that you outlined.
I think you're right. Maybe one way to think about it is it's almost more important to define what the roles are not than to define what the roles are, right? If you can place limitations on the roles to be clear that these parties who have management responsibility, investor oversight roles, things like that, that they don't have the authority to enter into day-to-day decision-making about the environmental health and safety practices of the facility that is operated by the entity that they're charged with, you know, executive management over. That is a really nice boundary, an express boundary to have up in the formation documents, the governing documents that define those roles and responsibilities. So it's almost like a negative covenant or restriction, right? That you do not have the authority to do the following thing. That is a way of, you know, holding up a document to be able to say, look, I could not have done these things because the traditional indicators of operatorship were expressly limited off of my role.
So Jason, you talked a little bit about the distinction between the holding of Best Foods and then what it stood for more broadly. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that a little bit more.
I think it goes back to what are the different ways in which you touch sites that are potentially going to have a release of hazardous substances that requires cleanup responsibilities or triggers cleanup responsibilities. And we don't only find ourselves in the circumstance where there's a parent entity and a subsidiary entity, and the subsidiary has one or more sites at which it's the owner or operator. Right? There are so many more complex arrangements today. From a transacting standpoint, we have leases and subleases, we have co-located sites, we have circumstances where someone only owns the infrastructure on top of a piece of land, but doesn't own the dirt underneath the land. You have retired coal-fired power plants that are being, you know, redeveloped. You have co-located facilities in chemical manufacturing sites where you have, you know, one part, you know, you think of a donut where someone's in the middle of the donut and someone's on the outside of the donut, but they have to coexist. And in all of those circumstances, where are you the operator, or where might you be alleged to be the operator if things go wrong and there's a significant liability where one of the entities is no longer present and able to stand up for the liabilities that arose under their watch, either as the named owner or operator? And then who's going to be visited upon to try to pin the tail on them? And what will the indicia of their touches to sites be that'll be used to pin the tail?
And, you know, as we're talking about indicia and thinking about this, I actually thought of a metaphor from my previous career as an educator, where we taught. We were fortunate enough to have a number of involved parents who cared about the school and their children, and faculty often developed deep and rewarding relationships with them. But then we also had other kinds of parents, and we called them helicopter parents, not to their face, of course. But what we meant by that was that some parents were always hovering around the school and eager to intervene whenever young Johnny had an issue with a teacher or a member of the administration or another student. And I was wondering if that could be a good shorthand for thinking about the types of situations in which somebody would come under operator status and sort of applying that to Best Foods and what we've been talking about here. Moving beyond just the normal interests of a parent or of a lessor, as many of the other relationships you've identified, and really getting much more involved in somebody else's responsibilities.
Well, having raised three kids in Washington, D.C., I'm familiar with the helicopter parent analogy. The best way I could draw that analogy out would be to say, I think of it as the difference between managing toddlers and managing teenagers. When you parent toddlers, you determine what food they eat and what clothes they wear and when they go to bed and things like that. And those are day-to-day decisions of that person's existence. And that is more like the circumstance where it's easier to hold you, the parent, accountable for the things that arise for the toddler. As you get teenagers, you try to empower them to make good decisions and hope that they do. And when they go wrong, you hold them accountable for the decisions they've made. And that's more the parent role in the parent subsidiary relationship. So I've gotten that far in my parenting role. So I think that that's maybe the distinction, or maybe the way to think about it in relation to parenting, is that if you're acting like the parent of the teenager, then you're more in the circumstance where you're not going to be ultimately held responsible for the acts of the teen or the liabilities of the teen. Under CERCLA, I don't know about under other laws, but that to me would be the way to think about that analogy of the parent-child relationship.
I like that even more. And one thing I was thinking about as well is that the takeaway from Best Foods doesn't mean that a corporate parent can't be involved in managing various environmental compliance issues in a subsidiary. It seems like what it establishes, or what it stands for, is that there's going to be a trade-off. If you choose to be more involved, if you choose to have that sort of parent-toddler relationship with a subsidiary, maybe because the subsidiary needs it, you may be entering into liabilities that you should think about, right?
You should think about, and then you should look into the toolbox of ways in which you can best protect yourself in those circumstances, right? How are you contracting with other parties who are in a position to control the risk? What is the wherewithal of those parties to honor their contractual obligations? Are there insurance products out there that could protect you? And who are the insureds on those products? Is it just the subsidiary who's obviously the party in direct line of fire, but is it also you, the parent? Is there an umbrella policy in place to take care of those circumstances? Not just as a parent, but if you're an investor, if you're a joint venture partner, if you're the lessor, if you're the owner of the equipment, if you're the lender, right? Lenders can find themselves in circumstances with a struggling borrower, where they start to make the day-to-day decisions of the borrower. And they start to look a lot more like a parent than a bank. And if they do that, they can inadvertently sort of step into the circumstance where they too could be deemed an operator under the sort of Best Foods type analysis.
Well, thanks for spending a little bit of time with us, Jason, to talk about Best Foods. As you point out, this case can come up in a variety of different contexts. And so it's always helpful, I think, to have Best Foods lingering in the back of your mind when you think about many of the topics that Jason has outlined for us today.
Yeah, happy to do it. I think it comes up anytime that you are going to touch another site, either through a subsidiary, joint venture, or a new piece of land that you come in contact with. Not necessarily that you're delivering a service at that site. Those are different circumstances than Best Food triggers. But if you are going to be in a position where you are carrying out the activities that are authorized by a permit, or acting like an operator at a site, or then you want to be thoughtful about how you approach the liabilities associated with touching that site.
Well, needless to say, if any of our listeners have questions about any of those topics, I think we've identified the perfect person for them to reach out to and talk with. So thanks for being with us, Jason. And thank you, listeners, for spending a little bit more time with us.
Thanks again for having me on, Daniel.
That's it for us today at the Environmental Law Monitor. Big thanks to our guests, as well as Dorn, Emily, and the rest of our production team who helped to make this episode possible. And of course, thank you, our listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.